Mr. Johnson.
Yes, may I please
proceed.
Thank you. Congratulations, Judge Woolman.
Thank you.
Your Honors, my first issue, my name is Thomas Johnson. I represent Mr. Bravo Lopez.
Counsel, if you can get that mic, just you can raise the podium. There's a button to your right there that yeah. I think we'll hear you a little better.
Okay, can you hear me now better?
Yes.
Okay. My first issue is the jury instruction on the defense theory of the case. Basically, the government's arguing in its brief that we waived our right to the jury instruction on Mr. Bravo Lopez's mental health. And I'm arguing here that we didn't waive it, and the reason why are the facts. The facts are clear in the record. We presented our instruction timely on the court's schedule. The court thought the instruction was a little verbose, but never explained why that was the case or pointed out specific examples of verbosity. The government objected. The court then proposed its own instruction. That's indicated in the record. Their instruction was based, the same as ours, on the voluntary intoxication instruction. And then the government proposed its instruction was based on the Seventh Circuit diminished capacity. So there were three instructions that were floating around. The court asked for my opinion with respect to the government's instruction, and I objected, and I gave specific reasons for those objections. And then the court announced it was going to give the government's proposed instruction. And we moved on. Subsequent to that, for the purpose of the record, I asked to be heard. The court allowed me to be heard, and then she asked me to prepare edits to the government's instruction, which I did, and which were made part of the record by the government. And that instruction, as edited by us, was never really taken up and discussed in any kind of detail, but it's one that we would have agreed to that wasn't our own specific instruction. So the issue here isn't whether or not Mr. Bravo Lopez should have his version of the instruction, but rather an instruction based on the evidence that was presented. We presented mental health evidence, and with respect to the issue of specific intent, which was clearly critical to our defense. The government indicates in its argument that we misstate, our instruction misstates the law, but again, that isn't inaccurate. We don't believe that that's accurate. Specifically, they cite that we didn't, that their instruction better underlines or better points out what are the specific intent elements of the crime of conspiracy and also of the kidnapping resulting in death.
Counsel, as I understand, you were able to introduce evidence of diminished capacity and argue the same to the jury, correct?
Yes, sir, we did. We presented expert testimony, and we also argued it in our closing argument. But Judge, and that's the reason that the government argues it is harmless error, but I would disagree with that because evidence and argument by counsel can never replace instructions, the authority of instructions given by the court, never. Those instructions that the court gives have the court's stamp of approval. That's the law that is supposed to be followed.
What was missing from what would have been before the jury that would have made a difference in this case? I'm asking for a demonstration of prejudice.
Sure, Judge. Specifically, the fact that was an instruction that would have acted, had they found the facts to follow to for that instruction, that was an excuse under the law for Mr. Bravo Lopez's behavior. And that didn't exist. There was no authority from the court saying that is a legal theory that the defendant is allowed to argue. It's just the defendant making an argument. It's not the same. In our view, it's not the same. For these reasons, Judge, we believe that the court abused its discretion and committed reversible error that should have given us the instruction on mental health, maybe not necessarily ours, although we thought that was perfectly fine, but a version of the other, and the court never did it. It just abruptly decided it was going to give the government's instruction, asked for additional input from me. We gave it, and then decided without any additional explanation at the time that there was going to be no instruction. The second issue that I would like to take up is the issue of the Sixth Amendment confrontation right. We were prohibited from crossing Mr. Souza, the government's cooperating witness, who was also one of the defendants in the case, on the issue of mandatory life. The court told us we could only talk about facing a life sentence. But we feel like the law actually says that defendants should be able to cross-examine a cooperating witness on the original punishment faced by the witness compared with a more lenient punishment as a reward through a plea agreement. A critical factor in whether or not you can do that is whether, is, as the court has set out in the Wally case, whether or not he's received the benefit at the time he's actually making his testimony. And this clearly was the case here. Sosa had already received the government's agreement to dismiss count two, which was the mandatory life count. And it was an important benefit, and it was fundamentally different from what the court told us we could talk
counsel,
about.
What authority is there that there is a fundamental difference between the jury being told that a cooperating witness is subject to life imprisonment versus being told that they're subject to mandatory life imprisonment?
Judge, the fundamental difference is that it was mandatory life is a minimum life sentence. A life sentence is a potential life sentence guided more by the guidelines. And the jury would have needed, the court would needed us to make
my,
that
my
difference.
Question to you is, where do we find law that tells us that's a reversible error?
The law is in the case law that basically if the jury might have considered the cooperating witness's testimony in a different light, then it's a violation of the right to confrontation. That is in the case law. And here we're saying had we been allowed to make that specific difference, because otherwise the jury wouldn't have known it. And we needed to cross-examine on a mandatory life versus just potential or facing life, because that way there was no distinction between count one and two. The government dismissed count two, which was a mandatory life sentence, but he pled to count one, which had a potential life sentence. And so the court, by forcing us to talk only about facing life, neutered any difference between those two things, and the jury wouldn't have known that unless it was the court would have allowed us to bring it forward. And that had so unwittingly, the court basically is bolstering Mr. Sosa's credibility versus us being allowed to show that there's bias here. And this is important, I think, for a lot of reasons. But importantly in that is the issue of the fundamental issue in the case was that Mr. Sosa testified. Mr. Sosa pled guilty to the conspiracy count, yet he testified at trial that there was no conspiracy. And it raises the issue of his credibility. How can you testify to two contradictory things? And we believe that led to jury confusion, and ultimately they ended up convicting him of the conspiracy, but we don't know exactly what they were thinking. Because the only conspiracy charge was the one that was charged with all three people. And that's the one that Sosa pled to. The government discount two, which is the mandatory life, which is what they were ultimately convicted of. And what was left out of that, and what seems like the case, if he's going to testify that there was no conspiracy, is why would he plead to that? So the question is, was he lying at the time of the plea to get the benefit of the reduction of the sentence from mandatory life to just a potential life under the conspiracy, which seems more likely to be the case than he was lying at trial about the actual existence of a conspiracy, because his statements at trial were consistent with his pretrial statements, and they were also consistent with another witness's statements at trial that there was no conspiratorial agreement. So we believe that there is this, we have met our standard of the Sixth Amendment, that the jury, had they known the true facts, the difference between had we been allowed to cross-examine on mandatory life versus just potential life, the difference between count one and two would have become evident. That would have also allowed us to discuss the issue with respect to where he was lying, why did he plead to conspiracy and not the other, because basically he wanted the benefit of not having mandatory life. He also testified.
Well, didn't the district court give a rationale for its declination of your request?
A rationale?
A reason for why?
Well, the reason that the court gave is it would come too close to sentencing, and that wasn't the province of the jury. But the reality, I believe, Judge, with respect to that is that could easily have been cured with a cautionary instructions the juries are presumed to follow once they're given, and that consideration shouldn't trump a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to show bias at the trial. And so I don't believe that her rationale for doing that was valid under the circumstances. It was a case where it wasn't enough. It wasn't like the Wright case where the judge told them they could talk about decades versus life. The guy was 44, the cooperating witness was 44 years old, and decades in prison was more or less tantamount to life. That wasn't Sosa's case. Sosa was a young man, and he had decades in life. I mean, that wasn't, it wasn't equal in that sense. And more importantly, for the sense that I just explained, the jury would have never known the difference between counts one and two and what it meant in terms of the plea agreement for them to dismiss count two, because he was still facing life on count one, which he testified he didn't think he would get. But the jury would have probably concluded, well, he wouldn't have gotten life on count two. That important, essential distinction can't be encompassed within facing life, because it just dilutes the difference between count one and two, which was unfair. The other issue that I would like to address is the issue with respect to the insufficiency of evidence on with the conspiracy. I want to point out that the jury instructions in this case actually, it's jury instruction 26, actually required the government to prove an agreement made by a verbal or oral understanding. This is the government's proposed instruction. It says verbal or oral understanding. And that means, in plain language, not written, but a comprehension of spoken language. And there was no evidence that supported that in the case. The people that were with the defendants at the time leading up to and through the crime were Sosa and a woman by the name of Zapata Delgado, who was up to their letter off. And then they continued on with Sosa. And both of them repeatedly said, there was no evidence of an agreement to rob, to kidnap and rob Mr. Escutia. The government doesn't point to any evidence that actually would...
Which two of the defendants pointed guns at the victim?
Which two defendants? My client and Mr. Kelly's client. But the difference
and
that I
was their intent at that time. I think the record is clear. They were robbing the defendant.
Yes, sir. They both pulled up to the house. Sosa testified at the time that their house everything was normal. No agreement. No conspiratorial agreement. They got out of the car, and at that point in time, they're involved in the crime. I mean, they're aiding and abetting each other. I mean, they did get him in the car. They did point guns at him. He had a gun too. But the distinction.
They forced him back in the car and departed.
Pardon me?
They then forced him back in the car and departed before police arrived.
They forced him in the car. They drove around, but they didn't. And they drove back to the house to let him off and saw the police and then drove and crossed the river into the bridge, crossed the river into Kansas. Right, that's all right. But my point is that there has to be a conspiratorial agreement. And you can't, under those facts, you can't distinguish between a conspiratorial agreement and aiding and abetting, because there was no evidence up to the point that they were actually involved in the crime. And there has to be some sort of a verbal...
Wasn't there communication prior about the desire that they were going to get drugs together from...
They were going to go buy marijuana. But there was no agreement with respect to kidnapping him, robbing him, or anything like that. There was no oral statement. There was nothing like that. It was all about let's go buy marijuana.
Does the law require that the agreement be either in writing or verbally stated?
No. It doesn't require it to be in writing. In fact, it's probably not going to be in writing, but it has to be an oral understanding, and that implies that there have to be some sort of spoken words that are understood, whether there's an oral agreement to do the same thing that's being spoken about or not. But the only agreement was proof of a conspiracy to go buy marijuana. That's it. There was no agreement to do the other part, which was nobody was ever charged with an agreement to buy marijuana. It was simply something that they were going to go do, but it wasn't what actually ended up happening. So I guess that we don't believe there's any evidence, and all the government supplies in its brief is conjecture, speculation.
Can't the evidence be circumstantial?
Of course it can, but there still has to be circumstantial evidence of this this verbal agreement, non-written verbal agreement, or oral understanding. The government's postulates other kinds of
circumstantial
things.
Evidence would indicate there wouldn't be a requirement for a verbal agreement.
That's what's in the instruction. I mean, the government argues there was a tacit agreement in its brief, but it can't point to anything that would indicate the agreement before they're actually involved in the crime.
Counsel, you've just about exhausted your time. You may want to reserve.
Okay. I'll reserve whatever's left. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Kelly.
Counsel, may it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, and congratulations, Judge Woolman. We'll definitely miss you. With respect to Mike's side of the case, I'm here on behalf of Mr. Osorio. I am a CJA appointment. I was not trial counsel, so I want to make sure that is clear. With respect to the two points that were raised on Mr. Osorio's behalf, I would quickly start with point two. And obviously, I'm going to recognize that Barraza is a controlling precedent in this circuit, that Rosamond came along from the Supreme Court thereafter, and then this circuit, I wouldn't say distinguished Rosamond, but certainly had a different take on it than some of the other circuits, and followed Barraza with Simpson, which again readopted Barraza's points. And so when it comes to specific intent, candidly, I don't expect to shake the earth here today. It is probably, we have an emerging circuit split on the specific intent instruction, whether it should have been given or not, whether death was also should go along with the specific intent. We expect that will make its way to the Supreme Court of the United States, perhaps in this case, perhaps in another, but that is why that was raised. I do want to follow up on my distinguished co-counsel's argument, which is my point one, about whether or not right should have been applied or whether it was correctly applied. I have two arguments with that, and then I'll sit down. The first argument is that right is distinguishable. The difference in Wright was that there was no materiality difference when it came down to subjectively, what the sentence changes may be from cooperation to non-cooperation. Whereas here we have a gentleman who testified in his 20s, and he got a 10-year sentence. And there is an enormous difference between the fact that he will probably be out for, if he lives a good and proper and healthy life, another 40 or 50 years, where the defendant in Wright, whether he received a 20-year sentence or a mandatory life, the difference was negligible. The difference was substantial here. The other argument that I would have is, and really what I want to spend the final 2 minutes on, is was actually quoted in this circuit's decision in Wright out of Larson, out of the Ninth Circuit. And it states, out of Larson, while the government has an interest, and I want to bounce up and down on that as hard as I can, in preventing a jury from inferring a defendant's potential sentence, any such interest is outweighed by the defendant's right to explore the bias of a cooperating witness who is facing a mandatory life sentence. And that not only is factually distinguishable in Wright from the facts, but is, we go back to a normative sort of argument. What are we afraid of here? Why are we afraid that a jury might actually hear what somebody might get versus somebody who is not? We are here in the state of Missouri where juries now have the right to sentence. I understand that in the federal system, I was a federal law clerk, and I know that to Judge Russell Clark, I would point out that I have yet to hear a circuit or a district court judge who didn't want to make sure a defendant knew that they were the final arbiter of sentencing. And I understand where that comes from. But in the words of, or in the to paraphrase, Judge Scalia, late of the Supreme Court of the United States, he was a big fan of, let's get the facts to the jury. Let's let them make the material decisions. And that didn't happen here. And normatively, I am puzzled why we have this governmental interest, which sounds like something that's just, well, you know, that was an interesting TV show last night, versus a constitutional right to go at potentially, and in this case, absolutely the most damaging witness in this case, without whose testimony the case becomes very tenuous, especially when coupled with my point number two. If there's no specific intent and that's a whole other thing, then that witness becomes critical. And the jury's understanding of that potential witness's motives of not spending the rest of his natural life in prison versus getting, for gosh sakes, a 10-year sentence is enormous. The instructions that were given were absolutely misleading to the jury, and that defendant's rights were violated. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Wagner.
May it please the court, David Wagner for the United States. I have just a few very, very brief words about Mr. Osorio's argument with respect to intent that death result from the kidnapping. He's acknowledged this court's controlling decisions in Barraza and Simpson, but he raised the possibility of a circuit split. I just wanted to note that nowhere in the briefs has Mr. Osorio cited any other circuit that has come out differently than this court's decisions in Barraza and Simpson on this question of whether a defendant has to know or intend that death results from a kidnapping. So I would just ask this court to follow its previous controlling opinions on that matter. Turning to the issue of the limitation on cross-examination, I wanted to respond to a couple points here. First of all, the district court worked very hard to accommodate the defendant's interests in fully cross-examining the government's cooperating witness, Mr. Sosa Perea. And the Supreme Court has said that district courts have wide latitude in this area, specifically wide latitude to impose reasonable limits on cross-examination. And that was the discretion the district court was exercising in this case. The district court was properly concerned that informing the jury about the sentence, the mandatory life sentence for the kidnapping resulting in death count, could cause the jury to improperly consider that the defendants who were on trial would receive that sentence if the jury returned a verdict of guilty. This court has recognized that that is a proper concern. Mr. Osorio points out that the government only has an interest in not allowing improper information to go to a jury, but I think it's more than that. The government, as well as defendants, has an interest in a fair trial. And that was the interest the district court was attempting to accommodate by finding a reasonable middle ground between the term mandatory life and some other phrase. And in fact, the district court didn't just come up with the alternative phrasing of its own accord. It asked the defendants what alternative phrase they would prefer. And while reserving their right to object to not being allowed to use the phrase mandatory life, the defendants proposed the phrase facing a life sentence. So the defendants were able to establish that the cooperating witness had been facing a life sentence under the kidnapping resulting in death charge that the government had agreed to dismiss. They were able to establish on cross-examination that dismissal of that charge was a significant benefit to the cooperating witness. And they were also able to establish that the cooperating witness faced only a potential life sentence as a result of the dismissal of that charge and under the conspiracy charge he pled to. So the defendants were able to successfully contrast the potential life sentence that the cooperating witness faced after his deal with the government with the life sentence that he faced before his deal with the government. And the defendants also went on in closing to argue that the cooperator had received a good deal from the government and to point out that he was no longer facing a life sentence. In this context, the jury would have been able to understand that the cooperator had received a significant benefit as a result of his agreement with the government and understood his motivation to testify favorably for the government.
Are there authorities that create a distinction between facing life in prison versus mandatory life?
I would point you to this court's decision in Wright, Judge Smith, where this court itself used the phrase facing a life sentence to mean a mandatory life sentence. I think that phrase was used to mean mandatory life sentence twice in that opinion, which I believe reflects that is the common understanding of that phrase, particularly when it's contrasted with potential life sentence. Life sentence, potential life sentence. The jury heard the distinction between those two concepts. And I don't think that the jury in this case would have received a significantly different impression of the witness's credibility had defense counsel been permitted to pursue their proposed line of cross-examination and use the term mandatory life. And that is the test that this court should apply. And of course, even if this court were to find that the district court abused its discretion by trying very hard to accommodate these competing interests, any error would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I want to clarify how the harmless error standard works in this context, because I think a little confusion developed on this point in the reply brief. The question is not whether this court can conclude that the jury would have convicted the defendants if the cooperating witness had not testified at all. That's not the proper inquiry. The proper inquiry, and this comes from the Supreme Court's decision in Delaware versus Van Arnstel, which is cited in the briefs, the proper inquiry is whether this court can determine that the error was harmless had the defendants been allowed to pursue their proposed line of cross-examination. In other words, had they been able to use the phrase mandatory life, would the jury have returned a verdict of acquittal? And the answer is no, because Sosa Perea, the cooperating witness, was extensively cross-examined by the defendants, and his testimony was corroborated by a great deal of other evidence in the case, including testimony from the woman who was involved initially with the defendants, Ms. Zapata Delgado, by Mr. Bravo Lopez's own confession, by the security videos of the kidnapping. Remember, this is a crime that was literally caught on tape. The defendants were caught on tape kidnapping Mr. Escutia, beating him with guns, forcing him into a car. There was also the forensic evidence of the victim's DNA in the van that was used during the kidnapping, the evidence of blood in that van, and the evidence of Mr. Osorio's DNA on the beer can found by the victim's deceased body. Considering all that evidence, it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that even if the defendants had been able to use the phrase mandatory life sentence as they wished, the jury still would have returned a verdict of guilty. It did not make a difference to the outcome of the case. Unless there are additional questions on that issue, I'd like to turn to the issue of the theory of defense instruction, which is an issue that Mr. Bravo Lopez has raised. I think it's important for this court to recognize how hard the district court worked to accommodate Mr. Bravo Lopez's request for a theory of defense instruction. The court initially found his instruction overly verbose and asked him to rephrase it. After a bunch of back and forth, including the district court trying to formulate its own theory of defense instruction, the government proposed an instruction. The district court found that instruction consistent with the law and appropriate to give and offered to give it. But Mr. Bravo Lopez objected to that instruction. In other words, the district court did not deny Mr. Bravo Lopez a theory of defense instruction in this case. The district court offered to give one, but Mr. Bravo Lopez rejected. He was essentially taking the position that it was his instruction, his wording of the instruction, or nothing. But of course, a defendant does not have a right to a particularly worded instruction. The only right is to an instruction that adequately states the law, which the district court found the government's instruction did. And Mr. Bravo Lopez has not attempted to articulate on appeal, either in the briefs or in his argument here today, what was legally wrong with the government's proposed instruction. For that reason, this issue is waived. The district court offered to give a theory of instruction, a theory of defense instruction, and Mr. Bravo Lopez objected. That is a waiver. It's just the flip side of the coin of the principle that if you ask for an instruction and the court gives it, you can't object to the giving of that instruction on appeal. Here, the district court offered to give an instruction and Mr. Bravo Lopez objected, which means the issue is waived. There was some discussion about the government's proposed instruction and Mr. Bravo Lopez's edits to that instruction, and I wanted to draw those to the court's attention because I think they're significant. And you can find that the government's proposed instruction with Mr. Bravo Lopez's counsel's handwritten edits at page A3 of the addendum to the government's brief. And I wanted particularly to note for the court the proposed addition that Mr. Bravo Lopez proposed, which was that having a mental disease or defect provides a legal excuse for the commission of the crime. That word excuse is important, and it was used here during Mr. Bravo Lopez's argument today. The reason that that word is important is it reflects that the evidence Mr. Bravo Lopez was introducing at trial was not evidence, it was not really evidence of diminished capacity. It was not evidence that served to eliminate the specific intent required by these crimes. It was rather what this court has referred to as diminished responsibility evidence. There was no evidence that Mr. Bravo-Lopez had a mental condition that would cause someone to be unable to enter into an agreement to kidnap someone, or to kidnap someone with the purpose of robbing them, or to have the mental intent to intentionally and knowingly transport someone while they had been kidnapped. The evidence, rather, was that Mr. Bravo-Lopez had conditions that would have affected his judgment, his academic achievement, his social interactions, his ability to plan or organize or learn from experiences, to exercise independent decision-making, and to be subject to gullibility. That evidence does not go to Mr. Bravo-Lopez's ability to form specific intent, which means that Mr. Bravo-Lopez did not introduce evidence to support his proposed theory of defense instruction. And I would encourage the court to look at opinions from some other circuits which have been cited in the brief that talk about this distinction between evidence showing diminished responsibility and evidence showing diminished capacity. Sometimes those terms are used in different ways in the case law, but this court has used them to mean specific things in its opinion in Barrett. But what these other opinions, which we cited in the brief, say is that courts need to be very careful to evaluate this sort of evidence because it has the potential to confuse the jury if it does not necessarily relate to diminished capacity, but rather relates to diminished responsibility. All that to say, the evidence in this case did not support the theory of defense instruction, which is another reason that this court should find that the district court properly declined to give it. And then further, the proposed instruction Mr. Bravo-Lopez submitted did not correctly state the law, and we've explained why in our brief. I'll just go over the reasons very briefly. First of all, it did not identify the specific intent requirements of the crime. It just broadly instructed the jury to find that Mr. Bravo-Lopez had the necessary state of mind to knowingly and purposefully commit the crimes. That was very confusing because these crimes have specific mens rea requirements for particular elements. And that sort of broad language was not a correct statement of the law. And then also the instruction effectively directed the jury to find Mr. Bravo-Lopez had the mental conditions he claimed. So for those reasons, the proposed instruction that Mr. Bravo-Lopez submitted did not correctly state the law.
Counsel, would you address the issues raised in the brief concerning Bravo-Lopez's interrogation, how he was kept isolated, not given meals other than some juice and chips?
Absolutely.
For multiple hours and basically kept up all night.
Absolutely, Judge. The context is important here. What was going on when Mr. Bravo-Lopez was arrested was the detectives and other officers involved in this investigation were actively searching for the kidnapping victim. The victim's body had not been found. The officers, I believe, probably surmised reasonably that the victim was dead, but they did not know. So they were actively searching for a kidnapping victim. Mr. Bravo-Lopez was arrested, and he was placed into the interview room where he remained for about 4 hours. It was, as you say, Judge Smith, late at night. He was allowed to rest, however, during the time he was in that interview room. The interview itself took about 5 hours, just shy of 5 hours, the questioning. But I think one thing the court should recognize is that during much of that time, the detectives were not actually interrogating Mr. Bravo-Lopez. Rather, they were all looking at maps to try to figure out where the kidnapping victim's body could be found. So it was 5 hours, which is a good chunk of time, but he wasn't necessarily being interrogated for all that time. Other times, he was given breaks. There was a few hours spent driving around looking for the kidnapping victim's body before they all returned to the interview room and the interview recommenced for about an hour and a half. Mr. Bravo-Lopez was given opportunities to use the restroom. He was given juice. He was given snacks. He was asked whether he was too tired to continue, and he said no. Under those circumstances, particularly in the context of search of an active investigation looking for a kidnapping victim who could be alive or dead, what the officers did was not unreasonable.
What in the record gives us assurance that he understood the Miranda warnings?
His own words, Judge. The detective read him the Miranda warnings, and he said he understood, and he said he wanted to talk. I think the court should take him at his word. Beyond that, what the district court found important was his other statements during the interview. The district court found that rather than not understanding what was going on, Mr. Bravo-Lopez presented as an individual who was being cagey. That's the word the district court used. And that's borne out by the transcript and video of the interview, which shows that Mr. Bravo-Lopez initially tried to deny involvement in the crime. But then when the detectives presented him with additional information, he would acknowledge a little bit more. He would acknowledge, okay, well, I was with them when the kidnapping happened, but I was being threatened and I had my head down and they were pointing guns at me. And then after they showed him the video of the kidnapping that shows him getting out of the car with a gun, he finally acknowledged, yes, I was involved, because there wasn't really much of an option for him to say anything else at that point. But throughout the entire time, even though the detectives pressed him to admit to it, he denied consistently that he had been the one to shoot the kidnapping victim, which shows that his will was not overborne. Another important point here, I think, is that the question of whether Mr. Bravo Lopez understood the Miranda waiver, whether it was a knowing and intelligent waiver, is a question of fact. And so this court's review of that issue is for clear error. And here, the district court did not clearly err. Mr. Bravo Lopez was 21 years old. He had attended school into the ninth grade. He was not intellectually disabled. The video shows he understood what was going on. And it also shows that he had the mental acuity to shift his story to adjust to new evidence that the detectives presented to him during the course of the interview.
His intellect was rated as borderline. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. It was rated as borderline. But he was not mentally disabled. And this court has even found that mentally disabled individuals are able to knowingly and voluntarily waive their Miranda rights. I think, you know, of course, there was an opinion by, a neuropsychologist in this case that Mr. Bravo Lopez was not able to knowingly and intelligently waive his rights. But I think the district court properly gave that opinion little credence. It was a conclusory opinion. I think that doctor had a misunderstanding of the necessity of a defendant to understand the consequences of a Miranda waiver. The Supreme Court has been very clear. And it's in a case we cite in the brief, Colorado versus Spring, says the Constitution does not require that a criminal suspect know and understand every possible consequence of a waiver of the Fifth Amendment privilege. What a defendant has to understand is that they have the right not to talk, they have a right to talk to an attorney, and that anything they say can and will be used against them. Miranda does not require more than that. And Mr. Bravo Lopez certainly had the mental ability to understand those simple concepts. The district court correctly considered the totality of the circumstances. It did not clearly err in finding that Mr. Bravo Lopez knowingly and intelligently waived his Miranda rights. If I could, I'd like to turn, within the amount of time I have left, I'd like to turn to the sufficiency of the evidence showing an agreement to join a conspiracy, because there was a few points raised during Mr. Bravo Lopez's argument that I think merit a response. The first is his point, which was not raised in the briefs, that the jury instructions required a verbal or oral understanding. I don't think that's right. The jury instructions said that a verbal or oral understanding can be sufficient. They did not say it is required. The jury instructions also said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, that a defendant joins a conspiracy by voluntarily and intelligently participating in the unlawful plan with the intent to further the object of the crime. This court's law isn't pollutively clear on this issue, that a verbal understanding is not required. And to the extent the jury instructions did require more, that to the extent the jury instructions did require a verbal or oral understanding, where this court's law requires only a tacit agreement, this court evaluates the sufficiency of the evidence according to the law, not according to the additional requirement added in the jury instruction. And that principle comes from a Supreme Court opinion called Musacchio, which I would be happy to send the court in a 28-J letter. I didn't brief it because this argument hadn't been raised in the brief, but Musacchio says that if the jury instructions add another element to the offense that the law does not require, the court does not evaluate the sufficiency of the evidence according to that additional element. The court evaluates the sufficiency of the evidence according to the controlling law. And of course, what the jury saw at the trial was evidence that no one could doubt showed an agreement to join a conspiracy. They saw Mr. Bravo Lopez and Mr. Osorio jump out of a car with guns drawn. They saw both of them simultaneously accost the victim, Mr. Escudio, with firearms, point their firearms at the victim, beat him with the firearms, force him into the car against his will, where they continued beating him as they drove around, eventually driving into Kansas, where they forced him out of the car and shot him 3 times in the head. A reasonable jury who viewed that the video of the kidnapping, which again, it was caught on tape, would have no doubt that the defendants had at least tacitly agreed to commit a kidnapping. If they hadn't agreed to commit a kidnapping, then what were they doing? There is no alternative explanation that any reasonable jury could have concluded. This court said in United States versus Winston, which we cited in the brief, that direct evidence of an explicit agreement is not necessary to prove a conspiracy. Instead, a tacit understanding among co-conspirators may be, and often will be, inferred from circumstantial evidence. The evidence in this case showed just such a tacit agreement and was sufficient for a reasonable jury to convict the defendants of conspiracy. I see my time is up. Unless there are further questions, I would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Mr. Johnson?
Yes, sir. I have very little time, but I would like to
We'll fulfill the minute. We'll give you a full minute.
Okay. Thank you. I would like to respond first to the issue that Mr. Wagner raised with respect to the fact that I didn't say what was wrong with the government's instruction. That's not true, and it's in the record. I mean, one of the most glaring things that was wrong with the government's instruction was the fact that it questioned whether or not Mr. Bravo Lopez suffered from the incapacities and borderline intellectual disability, those kinds of things. That's totally wrong. He did. The only evidence at the trial was presented by me and by Dr. Jorenti, the neuropsychologist, who clearly testified that he did have a borderline intellectual functioning intelligence. So I did point out what was wrong with it. And in fact, if you look at the edits that I made to their proposed jury instructions, I changed that. And I didn't change any of the parts that he argues now that about the specific intent elements, which they claimed were more clear than when in our version. I left those as they were. So I don't think that I waived it. And I would use whatever other time I have to answer any questions that you might have about anything else.
I don't see any. All right. Court wishes to thank all counsel for participation in argument before us today. We'll consider the argument in supplementation to the briefing and render a decision in due course. The court also notes that counsel for the defendants have served under the Criminal Justice Act, and we appreciate your willingness to participate on our panel.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, would you call case number 2 for the morning, please?
23-3214, Southern Iowa, United States versus Jonathan Sutton.